Ever feel like you're just drowning in information about stormwater policy?
Yeah, I mean, trying to keep up with it all can feel like you're trying to drink from a fire hose, right?
Exactly. And we've been doing some deep diving lately, going through a ton of material from the 2025 National Stormwater Policy Forum and, all the research and reports that go along with that.
Oh yeah, a mountain of information.
It really is. But we've pulled out the essential insights for you for this episode. We're going to focus on the key themes that kept popping up. Funding, of course.
Always a big one.
Always a big one. Then the role of states and localities, how those are evolving, the whole world of permitting and regulations.
Including PFAS. Everybody's talking about
That's
PFAS.
a hot topic, right? And then we found some surprisingly effective solutions that maybe you haven't even considered.
Yeah, things that kind of flew under the radar at the forum.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So we've got transcripts from the forum itself, of course, reports from organizations like the Water Environment Federation, WEF, those are like the science and tech experts, right?
Right.
And the National Municipal Stormwater Alliance, NMSA. They're the voice of the local stormwater managers out there doing the work.
On the ground, yeah.
Plus, we've got perspectives from NACO and the National League of Cities, NLC, those groups. And even a really interesting angle from the power sweeping industry.
Power sweeping. That's not something you hear about every day in stormwater policy.
I know, right? But we found some really compelling stuff from worldsweeper.com. We'll get to that. But our mission today is to cut through all the noise, all the jargon, and get you a clear picture of what's happening in stormwater policy, what it means for you, and where things might be headed.
Yeah, sort of separate the signal from the noise, right? So let's dive in. And I think a natural place to start is with funding.
Absolutely. The IIJA, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act.
Oh, yeah, that was
And it
huge.
was a landmark piece of legislation.
Yeah.
Allocated, what, about $55 billion to water infrastructure?
Something like that, yeah. It was a historic investment.
But you know what really struck me at the forum was this sense that even that huge amount of money, it's not enough.
Not even close. I mean, we're still talking about a funding gap in the hundreds of billions of dollars.
Right. It's mind-boggling. So why is that gap so persistent, even with this influx of federal money?
Well, I think a lot of it comes down to the sheer scale of the need, right? Aging infrastructure, climate change impacts, new regulations, all of that adds up to a price tag that dwarfs even that big federal investment.
Makes sense. And then there's the whole question of what happens after the IIJA money runs out.
Exactly. Nobody has a crystal ball for future federal appropriations, right? So communities can't just bank on that money being there forever.
Which is why the role of states is becoming even more crucial.
Oh, absolutely. States are really key in how those IIJ funds get distributed. They've got these things called state revolving funds, or SRFs.
SRS, yeah. Like state-level banks for clean water and drinking water projects.
Exactly. Low-interest loans to help communities get those projects done.
And this is where I think the research from Joe Kane at Brookings was really insightful. He pointed out that a lot of local utilities, they just don't have the capacity to effectively apply for and manage these funds.
Yeah, capacity. That's the big word. You can have all the money in the world, but if you don't have the people and the know-how to actually access it and use it wisely.
It's almost like winning the lottery but not being able to cash the ticket.
Perfect analogy. And Kane's research really dug into this. He looked at state SRF documents and found that a lot of them don't even clearly define or measure staffing capacity at the local level.
So, like, how many people do you need with what specific skills to actually handle these grant applications and manage these projects?
Exactly. And it's not just about the numbers. It's about having the right expertise. And, if we think about something like green infrastructure, those nature-based solutions for managing stormwater,
Yeah, green infrastructure is becoming increasingly important.
hugely important. But Kane's research showed that a lot of states aren't consistently prioritizing dedicated funding mechanisms for green infrastructure beyond the SRFs.
So they might talk about the benefits of green infrastructure, but they're not necessarily putting their money where their mouth is.
Or providing the support needed to build that local capacity. I mean, California, Oregon, New York, they were standouts, they're doing good things, but it's not the norm.
So you've got this disconnect. States are saying, hey, green infrastructure is great, but they're not necessarily addressing the need for skilled personnel to actually design, implement, and maintain these projects.
Yeah, it's a classic example of policy outpacing practice. We need to make sure that the support is there to match the ambition.
Totally. And this all ties into the fact that the role of states is only going to become more prominent. especially with all these gubernatorial elections coming
up. Oh, yeah, that's going to be huge.
Because changes at the state level can have a massive impact on how stormwater is managed locally. So what does all this mean for folks on the ground? Well, it really underscores the need for better collaboration between federal, state, and local entities.
Absolutely. It has to be a true partnership. Everyone needs to be working together.
And a key part of that is expanded technical assistance. States need to step up and provide more detailed timelines, targets, and criteria for their stormwater program.
Oh, yeah, clarity is key. That kind of guidance empowers local communities to plan more effectively and make the most of those funding opportunities.
Makes sense. Now, shifting down to the local level, there was a survey on stormwater utilities presented at the forum. And it really highlighted some interesting geographic disparities across the country.
Oh, yeah. Stormwater utilities. So for folks who aren't familiar, those are basically dedicated funding bodies for stormwater management within a locality.
Right. Like a water or sewer utility, but specifically for stormwater. And the survey found that some states have a lot of them. Others have very few or even none.
Which is fascinating. It really suggests that different regions are approaching stormwater management with varying levels of, well, let's call it enthusiasm, and definitely with different funding strategies.
And you can imagine that places without those established stormwater utilities are probably going to face bigger hurdles in securing consistent funding for infrastructure upgrades and maintenance.
Oh, absolutely. Having a dedicated funding source makes a world of difference. And speaking of upgrades, there was a lot of talk at the forum about the need for more resilient infrastructure, especially with climate change impacts becoming more and more apparent.
Yeah, it's not just about fixing what's broken anymore. It's about building back better and making sure those systems can withstand future storms and flooding.
Exactly. And this resilience piece ties directly back to the funding and collaboration we were talking about earlier. We need more creative partnerships between the public and private sectors to get these resilient projects funded and built.
Absolutely. There's a real opportunity there to leverage the strengths of both sides. So let's shift gears a bit and talk about the regulatory landscape. You know, there have been some pretty significant Supreme Court rulings recently that have implications for Clean Water Act permitting.
Oh, yeah, those rulings really shook things up, especially when it comes to the cause or contribute language that's often found in stormwater permits. It's getting a lot of people scratching their heads.
Right. Because previously, that language was sometimes interpreted pretty broadly. But these new rulings are raising questions about what exactly constitutes a cause or contribute situation.
And we're already seeing the impact. Some permittees who are facing enforcement actions based on the old interpretations, they're now seeking to have those actions reconsidered.
It's definitely created some legal uncertainty. But here's the thing. States aren't necessarily bound by those federal interpretations. They actually have the authority to set stricter permit requirements than what the feds require.
That's a crucial point. It means the impact of those Supreme Court rulings could vary a lot from state to state. We'll have to see how it all shakes out.
Speaking of federal regulations, EPA Region 9, which is out in California and the Pacific Territories, they recently finalized a requirement for general permits for larger commercial, industrial, and institutional sites in the Los Angeles watersheds, specifically those with more than 5 acres of impervious cover.
Impervious cover meaning like parking lots, rooftops, that sort of thing.
Exactly. So basically any large site where water can't soak into the ground. And this seems to signal a move towards more comprehensive permitting.
Yeah, it's about capturing more sources of stormwater runoff. And it's not just happening in California. Similar initiatives are popping up in other parts of the country, like in New England.
So it seems like the trend is definitely towards broader permit coverage. But of course, with more permits comes more regulatory requirements. And that always brings us back to the question of funding.
It's the eternal challenge, right? Who's going to pay for all of this?
It's the $1 million question, or maybe the $1 billion question in this case. Now, let's talk about another big issue that was front and center at the forum, PFAS.
Ah, yes, PFAS, the forever chemicals, as some people call them. It's a huge concern.
Yeah, and for anyone who's not familiar, PFAS are these man-made chemicals that don't break down in the environment and can have some serious health and environmental impacts.
They're everywhere. And the EPA is really stepping up their efforts to address PFAS contamination. They've got this whole strategic roadmap that outlines their approach, and a big part of that is holding polluters accountable.
Makes sense. We need to figure out where these PFAS are coming from. and who's responsible for them getting into the environment.
Exactly. And there's a lot of work going on right now to understand the full extent of PFAS contamination. There are national monitoring programs to track PFAS levels, especially in drinking water sources.
And permits are going to be a key tool in controlling PFAS moving forward. The EPA is updating their effluent limit guidelines, and monitoring for PFAS is definitely going to be a big part of that.
Right. So the EPA's multi-sector general permit, the MSGP, which applies to industrial facilities.
That's the one that's currently out for public comment, right?
Exactly. It now includes quarterly indicator monitoring for PFAS at industrial sites. They're basically saying, hey, we need to keep tabs on what's being discharged from these facilities. And they're actually looking for feedback on this approach.
Yeah, anyone who wants to weigh in on that, the comment period's been extended to May 19th. So there's still time.
Get those comments in. And the EPA is also working on reissuing the construction general permit with some updates specifically aimed at federal lands. So they're really trying to cover all their bases on PFAS.
It sounds like they're taking it seriously.
Yeah.
But one challenge that was brought up at the forum is the difficulty in setting water quality standards for PFAS that are both protective and achievable.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, some of the levels being discussed are incredibly low, like parts per quadrillion. We're talking tiny, tiny amounts.
Right. And it makes you wonder, are those targets even realistic? I mean, can we even measure PFAS at those levels reliably?
It's a valid concern. Setting unattainable standards could lead to widespread noncompliance and a reliance on waivers and variances. It might not be the most effective approach.
So what's the alternative?
Well, a lot of folks at the forum were saying that we need to focus more on source control. If we can prevent PFAS from getting into the environment in the first place, that's going to be a lot more effective than trying to remove them once they're already out there.
Makes sense. And they highlighted Michigan's pretreatment programs as a good example of this source control approach.
Oh, yeah. Michigan's doing some interesting stuff. They're working directly with industries that use PFAS-containing materials, helping them identify safer alternatives and reduce their discharges.
So it's more about prevention than cleanup.
Exactly. And it seems to be working. They've seen some significant reductions in PFAS levels.
That's encouraging. It shows that these source control strategies can really make a difference. Now, let's turn our attention to funding opportunities and some of the innovative financing approaches that were discussed at the forum.
The money. Everybody wants to know where the money is, right?
Always. So the EPA's Office of Water Quality gave an update on their main water infrastructure financing programs. And two big ones were the Clean Water State Revolving Fund, the CWSRF.
That's a mouthful.
It is. And the Stormwater Grant Program.
So what's the latest on those?
Well, the Stormwater Grant Program has awarded $75 million to 47 states so far. That's a pretty significant chunk of change specifically dedicated to stormwater projects.
Not bad. And it's not just about the money. They're also providing technical assistance to help states make the most of those funds.
Exactly. They're really trying to support states in developing effective stormwater programs. And there's this push to use those grant funds strategically, like combining them with the low-interest loans from the CWSRF.
Oh, yeah, that's smart. Blending those different funding sources can make projects a lot more affordable for communities.
You can really stretch those dollars further. Now, the 2022 need survey painted a pretty sobering picture. It showed a big jump in reported stormwater infrastructure needs, totaling over $115 billion.
Wow, that's a big number.
It is. And it just highlights how much work there is to do.
Mm.
But the good news is that there's a real effort underway to make sure those needs are accurately represented in future surveys.
So getting a better handle on the true scope of the problem.
Exactly. And it's crucial for states to report all their stormwater infrastructure needs, including green infrastructure. In the last survey, green infrastructure accounted for about 60% of the reported needs.
Which is interesting. It shows that green infrastructure is finally getting the recognition it deserves as a vital part of the solution.
Absolutely. And for folks who are looking for help navigating the funding maze, the EPA's Water Finance Center is a great resource. They offer all sorts of tools and technical assistance.
And I heard they have a guy named Travis Ostrom who's particularly helpful.
Yeah, Travis is the man. He's a great contact. Now, another key takeaway from the forum was the importance of establishing dedicated stormwater utilities at the local level.
The stormwater utilities, yeah. That recurring theme of dedicated funding.
It's so important because relying solely on grants just isn't sustainable in the long run. You need a reliable, consistent funding source to manage stormwater effectively.
Right. So how are communities finding the money to create and support these utilities?
Well, there's a lot of interest in figuring out how to quantify and monetize the benefits of stormwater management.
So like putting a dollar value on things like flood prevention or improved water quality.
Exactly. If we can demonstrate the economic value of those benefits, it might create new revenue streams to support these utilities.
That's a really interesting approach. It's like thinking about stormwater management as an investment that pays dividends.
And some states are getting creative with how they use those stormwater grant program funds. They're specifically targeting those funds to help communities that are struggling to afford CWSRF loans for stormwater projects.
Ah, so using grant money to leverage those loans and make them more accessible.
Exactly. It's a strategic way to make sure those funds reach the communities that need them most.
So let's talk long-term planning. The EPA has this toolkit that builds on the integrated planning framework that's already in the Clean Water Act.
Integrated planning, right. That's all about getting different parts of a community working together on stormwater.
Exactly. It encourages collaboration between departments like transportation, parks and rec, public works, all the folks who have a stake in managing stormwater.
And that's crucial because stormwater runoff doesn't stay within neat little departmental boundaries. It flows wherever it wants.
It does. So it makes sense to have everyone on the same page when it comes to planning and managing those flows.
But one challenge that came up at the forum is the mismatch between the 5-year cycle for general permits and the longer budget cycles that counties often operate under.
Yeah, that can be tricky. Trying to align long-term planning with shorter-term permitting requirements.
Definitely a hurdle. Now, for something you probably didn't hear discussed directly at the forum, but that our research has shown is super relevant and valuable. Power sweeping.
Power sweeping. For stormwater management, that's not something you think about every day.
I know. But the folks at worldsweeper.com make a really compelling case for it. They're basically saying that power sweeping is a super cost-effective best management practice, or BMP.
So like a first line of defense for preventing pollutants from getting into our waterways.
Exactly. Because if you can remove that stuff from the pavement before it gets washed away in the rain, you're preventing it from becoming runoff pollution. And the research backs this up. Studies have shown that street sweeping can be significantly more cost-effective than other BMPs for removing things like nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment, even those tiny tire particles that are a big concern these days.
Tire particles? I never would have thought of that.
I know, right? But it's a big deal. Those things are basically microplastics and they end up in our waterways. And street sweeping is surprisingly good at removing them.
Interesting. So it's not just about making the streets look pretty. It's actually about protecting water quality.
And it's way more affordable than some other methods. We're talking like 5 times less expensive in some cases.
Wow, that's significant. So are communities actually implementing this?
They are. Some states are even giving credits to municipalities for incorporating street sweeping into their MS4 permits. Florida and Minnesota were 2 examples that were highlighted.
So incentivizing good practices. I like it.
Yeah, it's a win-win. And these enhanced street sweeping programs, the ones that use modern technology to capture even the smallest particles, those can be a real game changer for municipalities that are trying to meet their pollution reduction goals.
It sounds like a simple solution that can have a big impact.
It really can, especially with all the focus these days on removing both large trash and those tiny micron-sized pollutants from runoff. Sweeping plays a key role in that.
So much more than just keeping the streets clean.
Totally. And on the topic of specific state initiatives, there was a lot of interest in Maryland's pay-for-performance program for stormwater management.
Oh, yeah, that's a really innovative approach. They're basically tying funding to actual water quality outcomes.
So you get paid based on how well your stormwater projects are actually performing.
Exactly. It creates a real incentive for effectiveness and accountability.
And Maryland's also becoming a leader in thinking about the intersection of flood resilience and water quality.
Which makes sense. Those issues are often intertwined. You can't really address one without considering the other.
Right. And they also emphasize the importance of maintaining existing stormwater infrastructure.
Yeah.
Because all those systems that were built years ago, they're starting to age and they need attention.
Yeah, you can't just build it and forget it. Maintenance is crucial.
Absolutely. Now, what about those big regional efforts like the Chesapeake Bay Agreement? Any updates on how they're incorporating flood resilience into those frameworks?
Well, it's still a work in progress. There are a lot of stakeholders involved, so it takes time to build consensus, but they're definitely having those conversations.
Good to know. And are there any plans to develop similar regional plans for other areas like the Mississippi River Basin?
Right now, there's no big EPA-led initiative for that, but a lot of it is happening at the state level. states are setting water quality standards and developing those total maximum daily loads, or TMDLs.
TMDLs, those are like pollution budgets for specific water bodies, right?
Exactly. And those TMDLs can really drive the permitting process and even help create nutrient trading markets.
So a lot happening on the state and regional levels, even without a big federal push.
Absolutely. States are really taking the lead on a lot of this. Now, finally, let's touch on some of the broader policy recommendations that came out of the forum.
Yeah, what are those key takeaways that we should all be aware of?
Well, organizations like NMSA, WEF, and INACO, they get together every year and develop joint policy recommendations for Congress. They want to make sure that lawmakers understand the needs of the stormwater sector.
So what are they asking for?
Well, a few things consistently come up. One is increasing federal investment in stormwater infrastructure. They're saying the current levels just aren't enough to meet the need.
Makes sense. It's a big problem that requires big solutions.
Right. Another thing they're pushing for is streamlining the permitting process. It can be a real headache for communities trying to get stormwater projects approved.
I can imagine. And lastly, they're advocating for more widespread adoption of those integrated planning approaches we were talking about earlier.
Because collaboration is key.
It really is. And ultimately, it seems like their goal is to elevate stormwater management to the same level of importance as wastewater and drinking water.
Absolutely. It's about recognizing that stormwater is essential for protecting public health and the environment. It deserves just as much attention and investment as those other water resources.
Couldn't agree more. So as you can see, the world of stormwater policy is complex and constantly changing, but there are some clear themes emerging. The need for more funding, the expanding role of states and localities, the increasing focus on emerging contaminants like PFAS, and the importance of simple but effective solutions like power sweeping.
It's a lot to keep track of.
It is. But hopefully, this deep dive has given you a better understanding of the key issues and resources discussed at the forum and in our research.
What are your main takeaways from all of this? Anything that particularly resonated with you?
Yeah, are there specific funding mechanisms or regulatory changes that you think are going to have the biggest impact on your work? What about those innovative solutions like a source control for PFAS or the cost effectiveness of power sweeping? Are those things you might explore further?
This conversation is just the beginning. There's so much more to learn and explore, and we encourage you to check out the resources we mentioned, the WEEF and NMSA websites, that Brookings report on SRFs, even worldsweeper.com. They're all great sources of information.
And as you're exploring, keep in mind the interconnectedness of all these issues, how funding drives capacity, how regulations shape priorities, and how those creator solutions can help bridge the gaps.
It's all connected.
And what about you? What creative collaborations can you foster in your own community to tackle these stormwater challenges?
Because we all have a role to play in protecting our water resources.
And that's what we'll leave you with. While the challenges are significant, the collective knowledge and dedication within the water quality community are a powerful force for change. Keep asking those tough questions. Keep exploring new approaches and keep working towards that vision of clean water for everyone.
That's what it's all about.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
See you next time.